Today's Teisho will be on case 45 in the Heikigan Roku, the Pien Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 45 is entitled Joshu's 7-pound flax shirt. Engo's introduction. If he wants to speak, he speaks, and none can rival him throughout the whole universe. When he wants to act, he acts, and his activity is peerless. The one is like shooting stars and flashing lightning, the other like crackling flames and flashing blades. When he sets up his forge to discipline his disciples, they lay down their arms and lose their tongues. I will give an example. See the following. Main subject. A monk asked Joshu, all the dharmas are reduced to oneness. But what is oneness reduced to? Joshu said, when I was in Seishu, I made a hempen shirt. It weighed 7 pounds. Secho's verse. You brought a piece of logic to trap an old gimlet, but do you know the meaning of the 7-pound hempen shirt? Now I have thrown it away into Lake Seiko and sail before the wind. Who will share the coolness with me? So I want to thank you all for coming to practice Zen this morning on this beautiful Saturday morning. Yesterday, I had an appointment, a meeting, in the morning, and on Thursday night, it was canceled. So I had another meeting. In the afternoon of Friday, starting at 1 o'clock, was a long meeting, a committee meeting that goes on for a long time. And I had to do a lot of homework for that, but I was able to get it done on Thursday night. So on Friday, after I got up and sat and meditated, I went for a walk in my neighborhood, and even though it was cloudy, it was very cool. You know, we've had a pretty hot summer, and yesterday was so refreshing because the temperature probably dropped 20 degrees. So you know, I put on my jogging shoes and I went for a long walk, like 4 miles, and I was going up through a part of my neighborhood that's really very beautiful. It's old trees, very tall old oak trees. And the neighborhood in general, I live in a town called Plainfield, is an older community, and trees are all very big. And the streets are all sort of winding streets, you know, so you can, it's really quite beautiful. A lot of people are sort of gardeners, you know, they plant interesting plants, and so it's really a lovely experience. So I set off on my walk, and I met this man who I sometimes run into when I go on my walks. He is quite elderly, and he has spinal stenosis. So his spine is quite bent over. And he has a sort of like a Brooklyn accent, and he has a golden retriever, and he doesn't usually have the retriever on a leash. They just walk together on the street, and he's a rather small of build person, anyway, and he has this spinal stenosis. And he was coming the other way, and I said, I said, "This is great weather, isn't it?" And he was just ecstatic. It was, he said, "You know, it's been so hot. This is just wonderful." He was so happy. So I went on my walk, and I ran into another person, and I said, "This is great, isn't it?" And the other person said, "You know, not f- you know." Basically, the upshot was, "You know, this is too soon. You know, I am not ready for this cold weather yet." And definitely, like, wasn't happy about it, right? And I thought that was, you know, it's something, it's commonplace, right, that one person would react one way, but and another person would react the other way. But, you know, it's very much the case that, you know, how we experience the world depends on ourselves, right? Depends on, you know, how what we perceive and how we perceive is very much a function of our own, what we bring to the table, our own assumptions and presuppositions. There's no right and wrong, you know. If you didn't like it, the temperature drop yesterday, that's okay. And if you liked it, that's okay. But definitely, those were like really contrasting views of the same thing. And you know, you don't have to go far to see that all the time. So, you know, I have a person in my office that I work with, and she is the kind of person who really likes to set boundaries. You know, so boundaries. So at you know, her, she gets into our office a little earlier than other people, and so she gets to leave a little earlier. So most people in my office leave around 5. Like my people who work I work with leave at 5. I stay usually, but they all go at 5. And this one person leaves at 4:30 because she gets there half an hour early and opens the office up. And it's like at 4:30, no matter what, she is out that door, right? And, you know, she just, those are her boundaries. It's like, I work until 4:30 and I will see you tomorrow, right? And now, I have another person who has a totally different attitude towards her work. She's the kind of person who will stay late and do the work till it gets done. And sometimes you know, she gets exhausted because she does so much, right? The person who has the boundaries doesn't do that much because she's always policing her boundaries, and if people try to bring her new work, she pushes back like, "Wait a minute, this is not in my job description," right? And the other person is, you know, has a very different outlook. You know, she's very committed to the work we do, and she sees these new tasks as opportunities to, you know, like, be part of it all, right? Be part of it all. So, you know, of the two people, these are both, people are both administrative assistants. And of the two, of course, I like working much more with the second one than the first one. I'm almost afraid to give the first one any new work because I'm afraid she'll get mad or she'll push back, you know. And the other person is like a real coworker, right? You know, if there's a problem, she's on it. You know, she will put 110% into it. And, you know, one person comes to work thinking, basically, how can I preserve the distance between myself and my job, which is a perfectly respectable thing to do. You know, if you want to police those boundaries, that's fine. The other person is maybe more invested, her identity is more invested in what she does, right? And that works. She gets worn out. She gets tired. And you know, sometimes if people don't appreciate her work, she feels used, right, or disrespected. And she's applied for a promotion several times, and I don't get to decide on who gets promoted. That's done at a higher level by the department chair. And she hasn't gotten a promotion. Last time she didn't get a promotion, and she was crushed. You know, she went in her office and she cried. And, you know, so she's very invested. So, you know, in a way, she has many more emotional ups and downs, right? I mean, basically, she does everything she does 100%, and she expects people to appreciate that. And indeed, I do. I always tell her what a pleasure it is to work with her, how she's an amazing person. And I wish I controlled her promotions, because I would give her promotion, right? This structure doesn't allow that. You know, these are two different styles of dealing with work, right? One person throws herself into it. Another person's very aloof, very protective. You know, it's like at 4, I'm not going to stay even till 4:32. I'm going to be out of here at 4:31, right? And that's a difference that has many ramifications. You know, so you can see where I'm going with this. You know, for one person, the cool weather is like wonderful and a relief from the hot summer. And for another person, the cool weather is a harbinger of a bitter winter ahead, right? You know, and for one person, the job is something you do so that you can have a life, and there's nothing wrong with that. The other person's job is her life, right? So I think we all know, in a certain way, that how we see the world, you know, let me put it a different way: we don't see the same world. We really, really don't see the same world. There's no right and wrong, because actually, you know, there are many different ways of doing your work, of being present on your job, right? And there are many different ways of dealing with climate, you know, differences in the weather from moment to moment. You know, if you were planning to go to the beach and it rains, that's a terrible thing. You know, if you have a vegetable garden, if you're a gardener in New Jersey and it hasn't rained for 3 weeks and it rains, it's thrilling, right? The other day we had a rain, and I was just sitting there listening to the rain. It was so beautiful. But if I had been planning to go down the shore, as they say, you know, I would have been bitterly disappointed. So we know on a certain level that how we see the world is going to determine the assumptions we bring to what we see are going to determine our relationship with what we see. And you know, this is really what Zen people mean when they talk about karma, right? Karma. You know, in one way of thinking about karma is like karma is like a universal law operating to sort of even things out. So basically, you know, many people think of karma as what goes around comes around, right? So if you are mean to somebody on Tuesday, maybe the next Tuesday somebody's going to be mean to you. That's sort of, or if you do a bad deed, you know, justice is going to follow you and you're going to be punished, right? A few years ago, I was very late in my office, and I was coming out of my office, and the one of the most senior professors in my department was basically stealing copy paper from the coffee room. And this guy has a salary, it's probably twice my salary, but he had like four reams of copy paper that he was taking home with him. I thought, you know, you can get those at the drugstore, you know? They're like $3.50. I didn't say, I'm sure you can afford them, you know? Maybe it was just he was in a hurry. I don't know why he took four, right? So you could say, well, that's karma. You know, he's going to pay, you know, because his printer is going to break down or something. But that's not actually what Buddhists mean by karma, right? I mean, as you grow up, you develop mental habits that that very much color how you see the world. And we underestimate how powerful and pervasive those mental habits really are. You know, so in my later life, I have realized how powerful my early mental habits really were. I've talked about the fact before that for a while I lived in Baltimore. In a neighborhood called right off Lock Raven Boulevard. It still exists. You know, I Googled it a few years ago to see the old apartment complex that we lived in on Lock Raven Boulevard, and it's still there, and it actually looks okay. You know, it's people live there. But, you know, when I was living there, I used to have to walk to school. And every day when I would walk to school, there was a certain element of risk because the bigger kids in the school would, like, beat up little kids and take their lunch money. You know, it was quite routine. So when I would plan my route to school, I would sometimes alternate my route so, you know, people couldn't track me down, or you know, I'd be very vigilant, or I would go with a friend, right? I remember once these big kids, I had a friend, Mark Miller, and we were walking to school together, and this guy came up and he threatened to beat us up, and he was really quite a bit bigger, and so we each had to give him like some money or something, and we went to school, and we didn't tell because, you know, somebody else would have beaten us up. So, you know, when I was a kid, I definitely developed sort of habits of being like secretive or furtive and fearful, right? Fearful. And I realized now in my later life that they colored many social relationships that I had later on. You know, it was like always afraid of... always afraid, right? Another example of this is, you know, my father was in the service. He was in the military. He was in the Navy, actually, a naval officer. And so, you know, when you get posted somewhere, nobody cares about what time it is in the school year. So if my father we moved from Baltimore to San Diego, for example, you know, basically right in the middle of the school year. So, you know, nobody said, well, you can stay until the end of the school year. We picked up. We wound up in the San Diego School District. And, you know, I walked into the class and the teacher said, this is Kurt. And it's like the middle of the semester and nobody knows me. And I don't know anything about San Diego, right? You know, basically, especially as you become get closer to your teenage years, everybody is giving you the sniff test to see if you're socially acceptable. And usually the assumption is you're not. You know, you're not a human until you prove yourself otherwise. And I would go through this again and again. You know, sometimes we would move three times in a couple years. So, again, it made me it had an effect. I realized... I tend to be, especially in my personal relationships with people over time, very aloof, right? It's like, you know, for a long time it was like people would be amazed, you know, I would just sort of like, well, goodbye, and that would be the end, you know? But I'm so used to, you know, I would make all these friends and then I'd have to leave and then I'd make all these friends so it kind of made me a bit of a loner for a long time. It took me a long time to break that habit. So, you know, I made decisions when I was in Baltimore about how to interact with people. And they were based on the real threat of physical violence sometimes, you know. And I made decisions about human relationships based upon being moved over and over again from town to town, across the United States and back, you know. So, you know, that's sort of karma. We make these decisions, we don't make them with full knowledge of the consequences. You know, we make them in order to adapt and protect ourselves, but they become, especially over time, they become deep-seated habits. And they affect how we interact with everything. You know, when people go into, say, psychoanalysis, of course, they discover some of these traits. But, you know, psychoanalysis, even psychoanalysis, which I respect very, very highly, you know, I think sometimes underestimates how profoundly what we see is influenced, what we see is shaped or influenced by our karma, by the assumptions we bring. And, you know, Zen is really based upon that idea. If you wonder what we're doing with koans, you know, you can't really see your own mental habits. You can't see your own karma. You know, I actually believe that when Trump says he's a very stable genius, he totally believes that. You know, he can't see his own basically mental illness, and he can't see his own fear of himself and the judgment of others. You know, when we look at ourselves, we only see what we've through a long process permitted ourselves to see about ourselves, right? So this is a big problem with, say, people who are we might say racist, for example. You know, nobody handed them a textbook and said, be racist, right? It's probably the case that they developed a range of habits, you know, a range of behaviors or attitudes that might in some ways be unrelated to race, like just fear of strangers or a fear of physical violence. You know, lots of different things can shape people's perceptions that are unrelated to what the particular subject is. So, you know, racists may be mostly afraid of physical violence, or they may be afraid of being abandoned, you know, actually. You know, so racism can have a lot of motivations that have nothing to do with race, you know. So, you know, we pick up these deep habits and we carry them forward, and they're not visible to us. And koan training is about how to undo the karma that we have without actually first having to recognize it, right? First having to recognize it. So, you know, if I give you a koan, what is the sound of one hand clapping? What is the sound of one hand clapping? You know, people, you know, sit down with a koan like that, and It at first, you know, they might try to figure it out intellectually. But then, you know, if they have learned how to enter mushin, to have a blank mind, you know, they're processing the koan in a different way. You might just say one hand, like a mantra, one hand, one hand, one hand. That means something, and then it really becomes sort of meaningless, like a meaningless phrase. And you're just sitting there on the cushion with a blank mind saying mentally, one hand, one hand. And, you know, the koan sort of, you could say, like descends into your mind like throwing a stone into a well. And it goes down, down, down through the layers of your mind, and it begins to like bubble or percolate. It begins to become, you could say, psychoactive, right? And then things begin to float up. It's like things that might seem totally unexpected and totally unrelated to the koan. So, you know, when people come into the Dokusan room, when we do our sesshin, people come in to meet with me privately to talk about their koan. You know, I'll say, so what's happening with your koan? And somebody will say, nothing, nothing. You know, and I'll say, well, okay, fine, nothing's happening with the koan, but what is happening just on the cushion? You're sitting there watching your breath, you're saying, one hand's what's happening. And they'll say, well, nothing related to the koan, it's just I remember when I was in the hospital as a kid, you know, I had pneumonia, and I was in the hospital. It's unrelated to the koan, but I just keep thinking about it. And of course, it is related to the koan, actually. You know, very often what they say and what they think is irrelevant is very much related to the koan. They can't see how it's related to the koan, but it is. And usually the teacher can see, you know, in a way, or can infer, you know, oh, I see where your big mind is taking you. It's like this stuff is coming up from below, and you're facing it, but you don't know what it means or why it's popping up. Sometimes, when that happens, the things that come up have a powerful emotional charge or a powerful emotional resonance, you know. So maybe if I gave you the koan, what is the sound of one hand clapping, and you're saying hand, 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 hand. You know, you might come into the Dokusan room and start crying and just say, you know, I keep thinking about the time I was in the hospital with pneumonia. You know, nobody came to visit me. You know, I was in the hospital. My parents came once. I was all alone. You know, the guy in the hospital room next to me passed away, you know, and nobody came to visit me. And I felt so abandoned, or I felt so powerless, you know. I tried to get out of my bed and walk, but I couldn't. I fell down. I couldn't walk. You know, and after a while, you know, those emotions may become very intense. But the interesting thing is that if you're practicing with the koan properly, the powerful emotions that are triggered by your memory of this event, you know, begin to go away. So you're sitting on the cushion and your mind is blank and you're saying one hand, one hand, one hand. And this memory of your being in the hospital with pneumonia comes up, and all those emotions come back. You know, you feel abandoned, you feel helpless, you know, you feel unloved, and so on. And all of that washes back over you, and it can be very upsetting. You know, sometimes it's a sheen, you know, you will see people just sobbing on their cushion. And they're not sobbing because their legs hurt, you know, they're sobbing because something has come up. But the thing is, if you keep sitting with this event, if you keep going back to the emptiness, the blank mind, after a while, the powerful emotional charge begins to dissipate. And actually, it might feel painful, all these emotions come back, and then gradually, the emotions just dissolve, right? And then you're sort of like in a neutral state. And then you may begin to feel like this tremendous buoyancy or energy. Right? This will happen to you if you do Zen long enough. This will happen to you again and again. You know, something will come up that triggers this powerful negative. And sometimes it's not a memory. You know, you give somebody a koan and they'll come into the Dokusan room and they'll be furious. And they'll say, you know, why are you playing these mind games with us? You know, why do you, you know, you're some kind of a Svengali, you know, what are you doing that, you know, this is manipulative and just angry, you know, go away. Or somebody will come in and say, I hate this or something like that. But they don't leave, fortunately. And that's another kind of emotion. When they're facing a challenge or when they're being asked to do what seems impossible, they blame the poor teacher who is only doing his job, or they get mad at something, right? You know? And that's a habit too. That's karma too. So maybe they're pissed off and they go back to their cushion and they're angry and they're angry and they're angry, and then after a while, if they just keep going back into blankness, into emptiness, you know, that anger begins to dissipate. First it dissipates, and then there's no feeling, sort of emotional zero, emotional nothing. And then all of a sudden, you know, maybe you begin to feel buoyant, and even this energy starts to arise. So this is working through a karmic obstacle, or purifying your mind. When Zen talks about purifying the mind, this is what it's talking about. So, you know, all of this stuff is in there somewhere. You know, these experiences that you've had that have shaped your mental habits are in there. And when you begin to sit with a blank mind, you're getting very close to, like you could say, the door to your unconscious, you know. And then when you begin to internalize the koan, it's like you're opening that door and you're speaking to your big mind or your unconscious mind in the language of the unconscious. And so you're saying, what is the sound of one hand clapping? And the small mind, the discriminating mind, says, that's nonsense. How can somebody clap with one hand? But the koan descends down, down, down into your big mind, and something comes up, which is karma, right? Is your karmic obstacle. Or one of several karmic obstacles, because there are many, many, you know. And what we're doing when we sit on the cushion for hours and hours is dissolve these karmic obstacles. And, you know, once you've gone through this process, you know, that event no longer has a kind of hold on you. It no longer becomes a... your mind becomes free from that event, or it no longer has like an active property, or even the character of the event can appear to change. So, you know, the first time you think about being in the hospital, you feel these emotions of abandonment, you feel the emotion of anger that your parents weren't there, you feel helpless. You know, after you work through the koan, you know, you might look back on that being in the hospital and you might say, I never thought about that nurse. This is very common. People will say, you know, that nurse came to see me, you know, 6 times a day, and I was in such despair, and she lifted my spirits. She would clean, you know, change the sheets and tell me a story. She would get me, you know, a glass of orange juice, and, you know, and, you know, basically, you might be flooded with gratitude, right? And a deep sense of compassion, you know, towards the nurse and towards yourself. And, you know, you never noticed the nurse because you felt so abandoned. But when you work through the karma, you know, you look at it in a totally different way. You know, doctors saved your life, you know, maybe. And this nurse took care of you like you were her own daughter or her own son, right? And you say, well, whatever, I never wrote that nurse a letter and said thank you, or you know, thank the doctor for saving my life. Yeah, I've been in that situation myself. When I was a kid, I had scarlet fever, and I was in the hospital, and I never thanked the nurse, you know, who took care of me. So when you're working with your koans, one of the things we're doing is purifying our body, mind, and heart. Or body, mind is really one thing, right? When we sit on the cushion, we're sitting in the body, mind. And body, mind together, you could say, our heart, or heart, mind, your kokoro, your shin. We're purifying, and purifying is really a very good description. You know, we're going through, you know, a lot of Zen practice is like pulling things out of a big bag. You know, you have all these karmic obstacles in a big bag, and you're reaching into the bag, and it's dark, and you can't see what comes up, but something comes up. And you work through it, and then it's no longer an impediment. And then you reach into the bag, and something else comes up, and you work through it, and you're gradually transforming your consciousness. And your mind, which is like a series of locked doors, you know, the mind is like a maze, and the maze has all these locked doors. You know, we're gradually opening all the doors. You know, each time we encounter an obstacle and we work it through, and it no longer has this negative charge, it takes on this even positive, flooding us with compassion and gratitude. We're totally transforming who we are. And this process goes on and on, and actually can go on and on forever. You're not just cleaning up your own karma, you know, you're actually cleaning up everybody's karma. So, Zen practice, koan practice, is really about this process of learning to see the world in a new way. And, you know, how the world looks to you is how the world looks to you. How the world looks is how the world looks to you. You know, even something like the environmental catastrophe, you could say, well, surely that's just an unmitigated disaster and a black cloud coming over the horizon, right? And it may be, you know, that the human race and much life on Earth is wiped out, you know? But even that, how you greet that event is going to depend on your mental habits, right? I mean, people who feel a sense of despair when they contemplate that event probably have lived with a sense of despair for a long time in many different contexts, right? Despair has become a kind of baseline position for them. You know, there's a wonderful novel called The Plague by Camus, and it's about a city that is quarantined because the plague breaks out. And the government doesn't want the plague to spread, so it actually shuts. I think the city was called Oran. And Oran is shut down, and nobody can leave. And the book is really about what people do when they know they're doomed, right? And, you know, and some people throw themselves into, you know, drunken orgies. And some people, you know, throw themselves off of buildings. The protagonist is a doctor. You know, and he spends his last hours in the world, you know, just helping people. So, you know, there's many different ways to greet the inevitable end, and one of them is to help others. One of them is to, you know, turn into a party animal. One of them is to, you know, lock yourself in your room and hate everybody. So, you know, how we greet even something like that is a challenge. It's like a challenge, right? You know, everything is helping me to wake up. Everything is helping. Just say that every day. Everything is helping me to wake up. You know, it's absolutely the case. You know, I've mentioned this before. There is a very famous Zen master who's long deceased, whose name was Jiyu Kennett. And Kennett was the first woman, she's a British woman, and she was the first woman to be ordained as an Anglican priest. So until Jiyu Kennett in Great Britain, there were no women priests. And she went to the seminary, and she was the top student, and she asked to be ordained, and basically progressive forces in the Anglican Church ordained her. But then she wasn't totally happy with being an Anglican priest, and she got very interested in Buddhism. And she eventually went to a Japanese monastery to become a monk, an unsui. And she was now she was again the only woman in this setting. And you know, the Japanese have many wonderful traits, but they're extremely sexist. Like almost unbelievably so, right? And you know, her presence was doubly resented because not only was she a monk, but she was a woman, and not only that, she was basically a European. So everybody wanted her to fail, and people would do all kinds of things to trip her up. So, you know, basically, you know, if you have to get up at like 3:30, our sessions, we get up at 4:30 and we go to bed at 10:30. But in many places, they get up at 3:30 and go to bed at 9:30. So it's the same thing. But so where she was training, you know, they had to get up at 3:30 in the morning. And somebody said, "Don't worry, I'll get you up," right? And then, of course, they wouldn't get her up. And she'd wake up, "Oh my God, I'm late." She'd hear the chanting, she'd run in, and you know, everybody would look at her like, "What the hell is wrong with you? You know, snoozing in bed, eh?" You know, and or she'd be asked to rake the gravel, and somebody would say, "Oh, well, let me show you how to rake the gravel," and then walk away, and then the supervisor would come and go, "That's not the right way to go. What's wrong with you?" You know, so people were trying to trip her up all the time. And they were, you know, hostile to her in other ways as well. And she went in to see the teacher, who was this very progressive Roshi. And she said, "You know, all these people are, they do everything they can to hurt my feelings and humiliate me." And the teacher said, look, everything is helping you to wake up. Everything is helping you to wake up. So, you know, what he's saying is get to the cushion, get into emptiness. And these things that are triggering these responses have their roots in your karma that you have to clean up. And if you clean it up, you won't feel defeated and injured and so on and so on. You won't. You know, your mind will be flooded with light. And she did that, and she actually, you know, became the star Zen student and received authorization to teach and started the Shasta Abbey in California. And then she got very sick and she went to the doctors, and the doctors said, "You have 6 months to live." And 20 years later, she died. So, you know, even environmental catastrophe, if the world's going to go down in flames, it's going to go down in flames. You know, and you need to do your best, but if it's causing you distress, actually, that has its origins in other things. It really does. That sounds crazy to say. But that has its origins in how you perhaps have dealt with other things, other catastrophes, right? You know, my mother and I were very close. I really loved my mother, but my mother was a catastrophizer, right? So everything was a catastrophe. It was like everything was the end of the world. And it's so funny because, you know, my grandmother was very opposite of that. You know, my grandmother was so serene. She could just, it didn't matter. My grandmother, unlike my mother, you know, had grown up in real terrible conditions, and you know, two of her children died. One of my aunt died of appendicitis when she was 17. So my grandmother had seen it all, right? I mean, her brother came back from World War I with a metal jaw that caused him so much pain he blew his brains out in the kitchen. You know, one of her daughters died. My grandmother had the most beautiful spirit. You know, she was able to deal with all of this, you know, with a kind of indestructible confidence in life. And you could say, well, how can you have an indestructible confidence in life if life on Earth is going to disappear? Well, you know, Earth is just one little planet. I definitely treasure it, and I'm heartbroken about what's happening. But, you know, on the other hand, this is a great opportunity to wake up. Everything is helping me wake up. Everything is helping me wake up. And if I'm stalled, if I'm angry, if I feel paralyzed, that's my karma. And the onus is on me to get back onto the cushion and get into blank mind and allow those emotions to hurt me again, right? And you keep going into emptiness and they begin to dissipate. And then you become emotionally neutral, and then there's this energy. That's like the life coming through, like the light coming through. This indestructible energy. And, you know, we don't necessarily have confidence in this process, right? The first 50 times we go through it, you know. Every time we go through it, we say, oh, this is terrible, there's no end to this suffering, there's no end to this. And then, you know, it dissipates, and then you're neutral, and then you feel good. And you go through that 50 times, and you begin to get a little bit of confidence in the universe, right? Everything is helping me wake up. A monk asked Joshu, all the dharmas are reduced to oneness, but what is oneness reduced to? See, Joshu said, when I was in Sesshu, I made a hempen shirt. It weighed 7 pounds. See. So, you know, basically, you know, this, like all koans, this has a number of little hooks that are designed to distract you. Joshu has unshakable, you know, Joshu has been through this process of being blocked and sitting with his obstacles, you know, again and again and again. And he's developed this tremendous, you could say, confidence, you know. Every obstacle, if there were one teaching in Zen that's like the essence of Zen, every obstacle becomes a door, or every barrier becomes a door. Every barrier becomes a door. That's why this collection, the koan collection, is called the Gate of No Barrier, right? Or the Checkpoint of No Barrier, right? It's like every obstacle in life, every barrier becomes a door. And so, you know, the spirit of Zen is to let me at those barriers. You know, let me at them. You know, I had a teacher once who said that the job of the woman of Zen, the job of the man of Zen, is to do the job nobody else wants to do. See, I thought that was, I think I started crying. It was so beautiful. So Joshu has that spirit. All the dharmas are reduced to the one, but what is oneness reduced to? So, you know, basically, the monk is trying to box Joshu in. He's trying to say, see, you're trapped. There's no way out of this one. And Joshu just, he is able to process all of this very quickly, right? And he has this unshakable confidence that he turns the obstacle, he turns the barrier into a door. You see his dynamic, life-trusting energy. You know, when you are blocked and you become dead inside and you sit with that deadness long enough, suddenly you become calm. And then there's like at the other side of that deadness, there's this energy, this pulsing energy. See, and after a while you realize, you know, I have to go through this process to get to that energy. But after a while, there's just that energy. So Joshu knows how to do that. He knows that the barrier becomes the door. It's like, let me at those barriers. That's the spirit of Zen. Let me at those barriers. See? Because I know I can work through them, and when I pass through them through emptiness back into the realm of form, you know, everything becomes so alive, everything becomes so beautiful. Engo's introduction, if he wants to speak, he speaks. And none can rival him throughout the whole universe. When he wants to act, he acts, and his activity is peerless. The one is like shooting stars and flashing lightning, the other like crackling flames and flashing blades. When he sets up his forge to discipline his disciples, they lay down their arms and lose their tongues. I will give an example. So when you're blocked, you work through. Setcho's verse. You brought a piece of logic to trap the old gimlet, but do you know the meaning of the 7-pound hempen shirt? I'm going to give something away about this koan. You know, in Alfred Hitchcock's movies, the bad guys are always trying to get something. Like, it's something. And basically, there's always something the bad guys are trying to get. It might be some code, microfilm, a diamond. And it has nothing to do with anything. Doesn't matter. Well, that's called a MacGuffin. And Alfred Hitchcock said, yeah, every movie has to have a MacGuffin. It's what the bad guys want, but the audience doesn't care, right? And so it could be anything, right? Well, hempen shirt is a MacGuffin, right? Who cares about a hempen shirt? Now I have thrown it away into Lake Seiko and sail before the wind. Who will share that coolness with me?